Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone. Your journey, our passion.
This is Auto Line After Hours with John McElroy, episode 248 for June 27th. Totally True Car with John Krafcik. Watch Autoline After Hours live at autoline.tv every Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time or 2200 GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or by following the links on our website. Hey, thanks for joining us today, everybody. We got a great show here. In the studio with us right now, we got Todd Lasa from Automobile Magazine. Great to have you here, Todd, again.
Great to be here, John.
We got Steve Finley from Ward's, Ward's Dealer Business. Great having you back
Thank
as well.
You. Nice to be back.
And we got John Krafcik here, too, with us, the president of True Car, and
it's
awesome
great to, be
to have you here.
It's great to be here. It's great to be here with you guys. Steve, you were my first interview, I think, after I joined the board at True Car. You're the first guy I spoke to.
Wow, great.
You wrote the most amazing story.
Thank you.
It was
You're
a wonderful
kind.
Q&A session. Yeah. Thanks for that.
Great information from you.
So True Car's rocking, right?
We're doing okay.
We had Scott Painter here last year.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was laying out all the groundwork. I was a little bit skeptical, but it looks like it's all coming together.
I think the story with True Car is, boy, we've been on this journey. And Scott's this visionary entrepreneur, right? And he had this idea, and he had almost all of it right. But he had some key parts missing, and he's been really smart about adding people to the team that fill in the pieces that he's needed. And you spoke with Larry Dominique. I know you know Larry,
yep.
Right, who was formerly of Nissan. And he came on to lead ALG. And what an amazing ad Larry was right at the time that True Car needed it. It was 2012, and there were aspects of the True Car business model that were just plain wrong. And we really weren't serving our customers, dealers, the way we needed to, right? But Larry helped the team understand. There's a guy named Stuart Easterby running the dealer operations side. Someone named Mike Timmons came in, did a fantastic job. He's an AutoNation executive. And really, those folks helped Scott and the existing True Car team realize they needed to make a few tweaks. So I've had a lot of success in my past having great dealer councils, right, and listening to those dealer councils or dealer advisory boards. And that was one of the first things they did in 2012. They put together a group of 20 awesome dealers, and they gave Scott and the team, you know, the hard gospel. It's like, wait, these are some of the changes you need to make.
And just to put in context,
yeah.
John, the problems were basically hyper-competitive dealers,
yeah,
race to the bottom, cutting each other's throat.
Steve,
True Car was kind of
exactly
in the middle of that.
There was an asymmetry in the way the data was presented. So True Car had always positioned itself and still is really a champion of transparency. But what does that mean? What is transparency? It's not transparency, or it shouldn't be transparency about a cost structure. It should be transparency about what other people paid for a car, for the same car that I want to buy. And I think that's fair, and dealers get that, and they're okay with that, and consumers certainly benefit from it. But back in the day, True Car was showing on that, you know, the Gaussian curve with the histogram behind it,
sure,
right, which is the way we present the data. There was MSRP, it's cool. Dealer invoice, that's fine, everyone shows that. But then there was dealer cost. And dealers would say, rightly, dealer cost? Scott, you don't know my dealer cost. Do you have the cost of the lights, the electricity, my
payroll?
The
dealer himself may not know.
I mean, right. That's, you know, that's all in my cost structure, and you're not reporting that. So it's not really fair, and it's not true, right? And so why would a True Car show dealer cost? So that came off, right? The pricing information that we provided to consumers, it wasn't easy for the dealer to see. And it was hard for them to visualize. So one of the changes True Car made was this tool called Sales Analyzer, which you guys know I'm a huge data geek. But this allows dealers to see all the inventory that they have and see how competitor cars have been priced in their local markets. So they can see those transaction prices. It helps them set transaction prices, their actual prices, so that they're close to the transaction price, sort of the market clearing price, right? So they can hold more margin on cars that they're short on and price appropriately for cars that they might be long on. Changes like that have gone a long way. We just made one that I'm really proud of, too. There was maybe a vestige of the older way of thinking. and that's factory to dealer cash, right? Factory to dealer cash, in a way, is an element of the dealer's cost structure, right? The consumer really doesn't need to know that there's a $1,000 flat dealer cash amount on a Honda Accord. That should be for the dealer to decide how much of that they want to deploy in the deal, right? So we had guidelines at TrueCar that said to the dealers, hey, we know about this flat dealer cash, so when you set your TrueCar price, understand that we're going to be removing that $1,000 on the customer savings certificate, right? And most dealers got that, but some didn't, right? And in a way, I think it was a little bit strange to show a consumer a factory-to-dealer incentive for some manufacturers that had flat cash, but not for others. My former brand had dealer cash, but it didn't show up in TrueCar. Honda's did. Variable dealer cash didn't show up in TrueCar, but flat dealer cash did. So it didn't quite seem right.
I tried to use that years ago before TrueCar and, you know, any of this transparency, because I knew about it.
Yeah.
And I was told in no uncertain terms, that's between us and the manufacturer. That's not negotiable.
Absolutely.
Between me and you, the customer.
And that, so had, that they,
they're protective
been,
of that.
They are, yeah. That had always been gospel at Hyundai, and I think it's gospel at most OEMs. The factory to dealer incentives are communication means and, you know, really important strategic elements in their plan to ensure that the dealers can represent the brand well and serve the consumer well. And when those are by line item exposed, I think it disadvantages the whole transaction. It's not good for the dealers, not good for the consumer. So we're now rolling through all of our brands. We've completed Honda, Infiniti, Acura, and Audi this past week and changed that presentation. So the flat dealer cash amounts are no longer shown on the savings certificate. Dealers need to account for however much dealer cash they want to put into the deal when they set the price in the dealer portal. It's had a wonderfully positive response from dealers. Relatively small impact on pricing, and now dealers have more direct control. And that's all we want to do, right? We want to give them the control to set the prices just the way they want. We want to give them the tools so that they can see the optimum market clearing price. And then from the consumer standpoint, we want to reduce their anxiety. Maybe the biggest change we made at TrueCar was in 2012, the mantra for the consumer-facing slogan was, pay the lowest price. That's tough. Pay the lowest price. And we had tools for dealers to use so that if they wanted to, they could almost literally press one button and it would reset their pricing on all their models to be the lowest in their market area. You can imagine dealer behavior. They're very competitive. I love these guys, right? But one of them presses that button, you know the guy next door is going to press that button too. And it really was, therefore, a race to the bottom. That's no longer a part of the TrueCar model. And we've gone from pay the lowest price to two words that I think are pure genius, never overpay. That became the new consumer promise. So TrueCar went from sort of appealing to consumers' greed, right? Pay the lowest price is sort of a greed-based thing. I want to get the best deal. I want to pay the lowest price. But never overpay is so different. That's responding to a reasonable anxiety consumers have. I just don't want to pay too much. And with that clever thing, when I saw it, I was still at Hyundai, and I thought, that is a really good idea. That's how we can all live together. Dealers, OEMs, and TrueCar can all coexist nicely with that, because in this world, that's really the most important part, is not overpaying. We finished this interesting study, just did this study. I don't know if you guys are going to have questions for me. I have so much to say. Is there a question?
Keep going, John. Keep going.
But
when you bore us, we'll interrupt you with questions.
Let me finish with this one, because this is awesome. We did this survey with Strategic Vision, and we asked car buyers, what do you think car buyers make? What do you think their profit margin is? And they came back and told us.
Car dealers.
20%.
Which car dealers would love to make.
They would love, right?
They would kill to make that margin.
So then we asked, what would be a fair profit margin for dealers on a new car? And they said 10%, you know, if only, right? If only. We asked the question another way, my favorite way. If you knew the car dealer was not going to make any money on the deal, what would you leave for a tip? And they said 8%. Now, NADA tells us in 2013, the average dealer margin was 3.8% on a new car. The front end gross, just 3.8%. Back in 2003, it was 5.5%. So the margins are coming down, right? Dealers are having a tougher time making margin on new cars. And yet consumers are thinking that there's all this money in the deal. And that's why the pricing transparency curves that we're providing, we think that's the answer to bridge what we call that trust gap. So consumers can see, hey, This is what everyone's been paying for a, you know, for a Chevy Impala LTZ package 2. And I know that that price here is a good price, and that's being offered by a dealer that's close to me. I'm good with that. I'll take that price.
What is the takeaway of that study in that people perceive this and are willing to pay that? Would that fundamentally change the pricing?
I think so. And really, our goal and our mission is by showing the actual transaction price, right, we can enable those negotiation-free transactions that benefit the buyer and the seller through price confidence on both sides. And there's a cool used car tool coming that I want to talk about that's aligned with that same idea. But that's the basic idea.
But it would almost infer that the margins should be boosted to 10%, right?
No, but it suggests dealers should do away with all their margin and adopt the restaurant model.
Adopt the restaurant.
You know, you just leave a tip for the waiter. They're going to make way more money.
But the other part of the equation, and I don't know how TrueCar handles this, so this question for you is so if I negotiate a price through TrueCar or whether it's in person at the dealer or through TrueCar, and say I'm not overpaying, say I'm getting a really good price and there's so much competition that the dealer is barely making any money on the car, then when I go in to buy it, I've got to sit before the finance guy for an hour, even though I've got my own loan there. Is there anything in the TrueCar model that handles that, that says, okay, here's the price we agree on, but I'm coming in with my own cash or my own finance?
Yeah. A couple of things. One is Automotive News has done a great job of talking about the 60-minute deal and how industry is pushing towards 60-minute deal. It's one of our tenants as well, and we're working with our dealer advisory board to put together policies that can get folks in and out of a store in 60 minutes. That would be great. And everyone's sort of aligned around that.
I mean 60 minutes just to talk to the finance guy.
Yeah, right? I know, right. Yeah. We want 60 minutes for the whole deal. Your point is it's 60 minutes in the F&I box.
Yeah.
It's often 60 minutes negotiating the price, too, if you break out the key elements of the deal. So if you can get negotiation off the table, you can say 40, 50, 60 minutes, right? That's great. F&I is another issue. It's a big profit center for dealers, and it's important for dealers. So the thing that we've been working on isn't financing. TrueCar has no plan to get into financing. We would never offer financing. What we'd like to do, though, is working with our dealers, figure out which of their credit sources they would like to provide upfront to the consumer and give them those choices a little bit earlier in the process. So if they know, if it's a Hyundai car, right, and Hyundai Motor Finance has a good deal, the dealer wants to share that rate with them while protecting their margin and reserve, then we would offer a platform for them to show that rate and perhaps a rate from a commercial bank that they might do business with or another source that they might do business with. I could see that happening where some of that work gets done up front, but it wouldn't be TrueCar's financing. It would just be TrueCar helping the dealer to present that financing to the consumer earlier in the process. That could make things go more quickly.
Now, I don't want to defend dealers, okay? But I will say
you only run a magazine that's all about them. But
I've never been a dealer defender. I do understand both sides of the issue. If a F&I guy says you come in and say I have my own financing, and he says, and this often is the case where they will say this and then follow through on it, I can get you better financing. Mm-hmm. If I can get you better financing, would you be willing to do that? And if they can do that, that's time well spent in the F&I office. Mm-hmm. And the other thing in terms of the presentation of products you might not want, if you're talking about extended warranties and stuff like that, if they don't offer them and something happens to that car and a litigator and the customer hook up and they said, did they offer you extended warranty? No, they didn't even talk about it. That could become actionable. Mm-hmm. So in some respects, even though some F&I guys can lay it on real thick, they have to present certain products just to cover their...
I'm fine if they do that as long as when I say no, a minute later I'm in the car.
Right.
That's
you should
the
be able
thing.
To say no. You're right. You're absolutely right. But they, in some respects, have a responsibility to offer the products. Now, you should not be trapped in the F&I office. You know, the thought of being held captive in a retailer's room is a little mind-boggling.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So people shouldn't have to go through that. But
I don't know if it's still true, but I'm intrigued by what you're saying about this do the deal in 60 minutes, because I know this goes back a few years ago. The number one complaint at Lexus, which has always dominated customer satisfaction, right, or very near the top, is how long it takes to buy the car.
Yeah.
Everybody says, I love the dealer experience, except that.
Yeah.
I just want to walk in, sign for it, and I want my new car. And I don't want to be there 3-4 hours.
You know what the average time is? It is over 3 hours.
Yeah. Over 3 hours?
Over
That's
3 hours.
Madness.
That is madness.
But that includes trade-in.
We had that experience recently, my wife and I, buying a used car. And it was just ridiculous. We went in with our own financing. We got the car. We got the price we wanted pretty quickly. We did a little drive in the car, a second drive. But then we're sitting in an office on a Saturday where just to get into the F&I office, just to sign the papers and get out of there, was at least an hour. So I mean,
it lost the sale with me. I'm not good at waiting around.
We were buying in suburban Chicago, so it was we were doing a long distance buy, and that otherwise I think we would have walked out too.
Yeah. Speaking of used cars, you guys just announced a new app today on your phone to sell used cars.
Yeah, we did. And I there's no really good way to display it, but it's here on my phone. And really proud of the development team and what they were able to do in a very short time. But it's called, can you guys see that? It's called, no, of course you can't see that. It's called Sell My Car. and I want to talk you through the idea because it's really cool. And it has the opportunity to be foundational and transformational for the industry in a good way, in a way that benefits dealers and consumers, OEMs in the industry. So right now, right, there's this pinch point on and a friction point on how much should I pay for a new car. And TrueCar tries to solve that by providing price confidence so you can see if you're getting a fair car and sure you're not overpaying. The used car side is even more challenging, right? There's no MSRP anchor. You don't really even know
where to start. And every used car is different, even if it's the same model.
Yeah, they're all different. They have different wear and age and mileage and conditions and all kinds of stuff, right? So we looked at data this way, and I found this very, very surprising. For every 100 new cars sold, there are 75 used cars disposed of as part of that transaction, right? Of those 75, guess how many end up at the new car dealer as a trade-in? What would you guess? Of the 75?
25?
No, I'd say 50.
I'd say a lot more than that.
That was my guess, 50.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd say more than that because they're holding on to some of those cars.
You'd think, right? 30.
30? Well,
hey, I was
45. I know. That's why I tried to set you off because you were darn close.
And the reason is that's a low rate. Why?
Why do you think?
My guess is based on your app that, what we were just talking about, it takes a long time for a dealer to figure out what's the value of this car. Yeah. And if they've got to go out and study it themselves, there's even, you know, so.
Yeah. I think in the end, it comes down to price confidence or lack of confidence that the price they will be offered is going to be a price that they should be happy with. And they don't really have a good way of knowing or checking. So their instinct is, I'll just sell it on my own. I can probably do better. They don't know what they're signing up for, though, because selling a car on your own is a big pain in the butt. I mean, what do you do? It takes on average 30 days to sell a car on your own. And it means, you know, it's Craigslist or, you know, who knows, but you've got strange people calling you or emailing you or knocking on your door. And none of those things are good things, right, in our busy lives. So the idea with Sell My Car is to do essentially put together a virtual condition report, right, Steve, where we guide you with the app around the car, taking photos of the car, get you inside the car, start the car, make sure it runs, asking questions as you go. You're answering yes or no to a lot of different things, picture of the odometer. When you're done, you've put together the most awesome virtual condition report the industry's ever seen. And don't forget, car dealers buy cars based on virtual condition reports all the time, right? Off of auction, on the internet, you're just buying the car based on a few photos and a few words. This will be an extraordinarily comprehensive condition report that the consumer will put together in 15 minutes. And when they're done, they press send a dealer, and it gets introduced to TrueCar dealers who will have the opportunity to provide a price on it, right? So that's pretty cool, but I know what you're thinking. That doesn't solve the problem of price confidence. How do I know I'm getting the right price, a fair price from the dealer? Just because it's being, you know, driven through a TrueCar portal doesn't mean that it's going to be a good price, right? Our solution is we're going to guarantee a price when we get to the second phase of this, perhaps by the end of this year. So in that case, you do this virtual condition report, and instead of pressing send a dealer, you press what's the value of my car? And we give you a number on the spot. Whoa. And that number is good at any of the 8,000 certified TrueCar dealers. You take your car there. They walk through that condition report with you and make sure that it's correct. If it's not, a variance report will be delivered that indicates these are the points of discrepancy and here's the value of the discrepancy. And boom, they write you a check.
How do you guys figure out that?
At the dealership. Well, we have ALG and Larry and his smart team of data scientists at ALG.
But, so, you know, used cars have all different kinds of miles and wear and tear on them, and it varies by region as well, and even probably by season.
We've been doing that for years with a product called ClearBook, which hasn't really gotten a whole lot of... Steve, does ClearBook register for you? If you go to TrueCar.com and try and buy a used car, you'll see those same pricing curves that we have on our new car site. But we've been building that knowledge and capability on the used car side as well. And now we're adding additional analytical tools and massively smart data scientists and incredibly powerful computers so that in the end, we're going to have the ability to value every car on the road in the U.S., every car in everyone's garage. Who cares to fill out one of these condition reports because we need the condition? So think Zillow, right? There's a Z estimate on every house. We'll have an estimate on every car for everyone who cares to fill out one of these condition reports.
What I like about it is that it educates the consumer on how to fill out the report and how to fill it out accurately. Because one of the big disconnects is what the consumer thinks that car is worth and what it is actually worth. Forget about what the dealer might be offering. The consumer invariably thinks it's worth more.
Yep.
And excellent condition is here, and average condition is here, and some people don't quite understand the difference. So if you can educate them on that.
Yeah, a lot of photos helpful here. So, for example, we asked for dealer input on this, and they were clear. They want pictures of every wheel because consumers sometimes curb wheels, and that's really expensive, especially a $500, $600 aluminum wheel. Right?
Well, and forgive me, I'm kind of catching up because I'm not as... caught up on the sales side as Steve is certainly, but so you're really pretty much throwing out the old paradigm of I bring my old car in to the dealership to look at a brand new car, and the dealer is giving me like three times the value of the car, and that's just basically money off the sticker price. So you're obviously already by going to TrueCar showing me what I'm going to pay actual price for the car. And so that it throws out that part for the dealer. The dealer can't do that and, you know, offer you $1,000 more for your used car than what it's worth as a result.
The issue now is dealers aren't getting very many used cars. Of those 75 that are coming in, they're getting 30. Consumers are selling 45. So and they're desperate. They would love more cars. And it's not easy. They can't just start paying more cars to consumers because I think there is that trust gap issue, right? We're known for providing pricing that's fair, right? And we're hoping to apply that trust mark to the used car market as well to give consumers confidence that if it's a TrueCar guaranteed price, that it's a fair price. And then they'll leave that car with the dealer.
Well, Todd brings out a good point, though. Sometimes a dealer will offer more than that car is worth so he can seal the deal.
Often, or at least that was the old model.
Right. You know? So, you're getting a better deal than
if they wanted to pay more for the car than the TrueCar guaranteed price. That would be fine.
And especially if it's an old car. And then I guess that's the other question. I mean,
back to 1990. I don't think we'll cover more than 25 years.
Well, but that's a lot further back than I would have guessed because, or let's say the value of the car being, say, $2,000 or $3,000 because a brand new car dealer is not going to sell.
Yeah, yeah. It's tougher.
Much
it's true.
Under $10,000 these days, right?
We need to work that out. You bring up a really good point, Todd. For cars that are very, very low value, it's difficult. And the dealer, it might be worth more, quite a hassle for them.
But even so, what you're capturing with the sell my car would be the dealers, what dealers are actually paying for these used cars, right? Is that essentially it? Or
the value.
You don't get the bell curve thing for your used car, do you? Or what?
No. Possibly in later iterations.
It's more of a residual issue, isn't it, than a what dealers are paying issue?
When you say residuals,
what the car is actually worth.
What the car is actually worth today. Mm-hmm. I mean, we do plan extensions of the product because we imagine folks, when they get a car or maybe 6 months after they buy a car, wondering, what is my car worth today? And maybe doing a sell my car assessment. What's the value of my car? Sort of like Mint.com and some of the other things in Quicken that you use to value your assets. We think people might begin to think of their automobiles more as a liquid asset because it becomes much more liquid in this way if you can transact it in 30 minutes. You know.
But just to clarify, the number you will give is the number that the dealer would on average pay. It's the wholesale price.
It's a guaranteed price,
right?
That will back, right? Oh, okay. And the dealer will pay the consumer that price. If they want to keep the car, they keep the car. If they don't want to keep the car, they don't have to keep the car.
Yeah,
we'll reimburse the dealer
and
take care of the remarketing and back-end side, which is one of the reasons why you can imagine logistics here. We're going to be rolling this out on a region-by-region basis before we go across.
But wouldn't the dealer, if he or she's happy to take the car, let's say it's a $3,000 car and the dealer's just not going to put it on his lot, wouldn't he be happy to pay the $3,000 and then just auction it off himself as
if he has the sense based on his local market knowledge that he can do better?
Okay.
Yeah, he may very well do that.
Right. Take some of the friction out of the trade.
Yeah, so two major friction points, right? Am I paying the right price for a new car?
Right.
And am I getting a fair price on my used car? We have eliminated or substantially reduced both of those, right? So now this whole transaction goes very, very smoothly. So the next iteration of the app, you can imagine buy a car, value my car, sell my car, and then my favorite, upgrade. Hmm. Upgrade is an amazing thought. John, you get it right away, but this idea, right, that you have this value of your used car and you can transact it instantly because it's continuously updated on a daily basis. You know you have price confidence on the new car that you want to buy, and maybe you've answered a short survey that we could provide saying, hey, for your next car, what would you be interested in? What type of car? What brand, what body style, whatever, hit upgrade, and we can work with our dealer partners and OEMs to find ways to get you into a brand new car at the same monthly payment, for example, or at monthly payment plus $20 or minus $20 or whatever parameter you may have.
There was a study that said 37% of people felt that the dealer didn't give them a fair price on their used car trade-in.
Yeah.
And they were right.
Well, it's their perception anyways. Perception is reality. And it's a real big cause of customer dissatisfaction.
It is, yeah. And that uncertainty leads to the fact now that new car dealers find it hard to have sufficient used car inventory to help with their overall store margins. Again, the NADA values 13% margin on a used car, just 3.8 for a new car.
Hey, we've got some quick questions here before we go to the break from the audience. Go Mango says, I just noticed CarWoo.com redirects to TrueCar. Did TrueCar buy CarWoo? And what happened to CarWoo's business model?
It's interesting. So Tommy McClung is someone I've just come to meet at TrueCar. Tommy was a CarWoo guy. And as it turns out, TrueCar did end up acquiring most of the key people on the CarWoo team.
Gotcha. So it is part of TrueCar. Yeah. Roman Koch wants to know, what's the most difficult data to obtain?
Most difficult data to obtain, I guess, I wonder what context. Let's imagine a context. What? you mean from a customer or?
I don't know. You answer the question.
Well, you know,
you interpret the question, then answer.
Yeah.
Okay.
To Scott,
we'll go on.
Interpret the question for me.
Scott said, all this data is out there. It's amazing, you know, whether it's government data, you know, Department of Motor Vehicle data, or finance data. I mean,
there's
you got
a lot of data streams
privacy,
that are out there that can be purchased, and most of them, though, and I think increasingly people are doing a better job at securing personal information. At TrueCar, I got to tell you, we don't sell any data. We don't sell it. We our number one shareholder is USAA. USAA has the highest security standards I've ever seen, higher than an OEM would have. And all of our platforms and programs meet USAA's high standard at TrueCar. So we do a really great job at protecting personal information. We do a great job with that. And we never sell data. There's still this misperception out there. I don't know why, Steve, that you know, we plug into dealers' DMS and then sell the data. The only thing we use their data for is to sales match, right? So folks come in through the TrueCar portal with their registration data. We look for the sale on the other side, and if there's a match, that's how we invoice. It's a pay-for-sale model. And then we use the pricing data to inform the curve. That's all we've you've ever done with the dealer data.
I think there's got to be perception, John, that, you know, with what Google and Facebook and all those
yeah.
give away, what they sell, rather, what data they keep, what yeah. data they sell, you just kind of get lumped in with them.
I know, and I worry about that. And actually, as an American company that's thinking about eventually doing business in other global markets, right, it's something we've just begun to think about. And it's sort of unfortunate because of what has happened with, you know, the various issues, the governmental issues, the NSA issues, right? And then the situation with Google and Facebook on privacy concerns. It makes it hard for an American brand company, which is TrueCar, moving into global markets,
what
right?
What market are
with
you
that
looking
precision.
At?
Mm-hmm.
Which ones?
I couldn't say. So let's go to another question
with
here.
A C, I bet.
Hey. Ben, I see that we got a phone call here. Let's bring in that phone call.
My name is Clem Zarowski from Delmont, Pennsylvania. When the dealer offers to show you the invoice on the car, what do you look for to see what he is really offering you? What do you look for? Thank you.
Yeah. Bye. That's a good question. There's usually a dealer invoice line that's pretty clear. You can find it on TrueCar.com as well, the dealer invoice for any car that you might care to build. You can even find it in manufacturer press releases. I mean, Hyundai used to fully disclose, for example, MSRP and dealer invoice for all its cars. And it's just out there. It's sort of a common...
Genie's out of that bottle.
Yeah. So invoices there. Interestingly, I've found that in most other global markets, that's not the case. And it's much, much more difficult to understand what invoice is. But dealer invoice is sort of shorthand. It's not dealer cost, you know? It's not necessarily what the dealer paid when all is said and done, because there are so many other opportunities and avenues for the dealer to be compensated, because they need to be compensated in so many other areas. I mean, you look at what GM dealers are going through right now from a recall campaign standpoint, right? There's a lot of work to being a franchise dealer.
Yes, there is. So let's take a quick commercial break. Let's come back and talk about some of the news that we've been seeing develop this week. So, Ben, let's give a shout out to our good friends at Firestone.
Introducing a car company that's never made a single car. We took the power of a 9-year-old V8 and gave it the impressive handling of Firestone's Destination tire. Now, moms agree. Every milk run feels like a victory lap. So whatever you drive, drive a Firestone.
You already know that you can listen to Autoline's Industry Insight in places like YouTube and Stitcher, but did you know that you can also listen to it live in your car? It's simple. Just pair your smartphone with your vehicle's Bluetooth connection or plug into the aux jack. Then navigate to Autoline.tv using your phone's browser. Find the show you want to hear and click play, just like you would on your computer.
This is Autoline After Hours with John McElroy.
It's that easy. Never be disconnected from Autoline's top-notch insider information with Autoline on the go.
Okay, now to the news segment. Todd, I'm dying to ask you. Ford showed the new Ford Edge.
New
this
Ford
week.
Edge, yes.
And crossover vehicle.
Crossover vehicle. They sell about 120,000-130,000 per year in the United States, and of course sell some in Canada and Mexico. This will go international. They're going to sell it in Europe. They'll sell it in China as well. It's based on the Ford Fusion platform.
And that's,
so it's
that's what knocked platform. Me out. I had no idea that this was coming, that it was going to be based on the Fusion.
But the Fusion is going to be the basis for a lot of things,
yes,
including
right.
the next Taurus, and therefore one would suspect the next Explorer as well. So it's, you know, that old platform, someone asked what the old platform was, and we couldn't get exactly a clear answer. I remember it was developed along with the Mazda CX-7. So it had a little bit of that DNA of the old Mazda 6/Fusion platform in it. This one is all new, of course. A lot of tech features in it. Three engines. The 3.5-liter V6 carries over. There will be a what are the EcoBoost? The 2.7.
The new 2.7,
which is the F-150 engine, and the 2-liter EcoBoost is the base engine.
Gasoline.
Yeah, and that's the carryover. Well, you can get the current model with the 2-liter EcoBoost, but this is, they claim, a heavily reworked version with a twin-scroll turbo. And you can now get that 2-liter, you will be able to get the 2-liter turbo EcoBoost with all-wheel drive and with a towing package that'll tow up to 3,500 pounds. Goes on sale very, very late this year, almost the beginning of next year.
And a 2-liter diesel in Europe.
In Europe, yes.
So, and that's
which makes sense because they've got to have that for the Mondeo, which is the Fusion.
Well, you got to have diesels for Europe anyway, right? I mean, mm-hmm. Half the market's diesel. So,
also importantly, there will be in the U.S. a titanium version. So, going up one more level on the trim levels, which means that when that next Lincoln MKX comes out, which will also be on the same platform but have the unique sheet metal. There will be some overlap between the top end titaniums and the entry level Lincoln MKXs.
We reported today we didn't know if Europe would get a Vignale edition.
That's a good question. I mean, they showed Vignale in the Mondeo, and I think they hinted that there'd be a Focus perhaps in Europe, which makes sense. You know, I think it depends on how much success they have with those trim levels, but I wouldn't be surprised.
How tricky,
since there'll be no Lincoln there.
How tricky do you think it is to stop at the titanium and start at the Lincoln? How big is the gap between the two before you start bumping up against?
Well, I think there's some overlap already. If you look at the Lincoln MKC, which I just drove for the first time a few weeks ago, and the base price there, and then if you look at what you can do with an Edge titanium, you can easily breach that $34,000 or so base price of the Lincoln, and you can get a lot of stuff in it. They're doing a pretty good job, at least in the MKC versus the Ford Escape, of delineating the interiors. The interior is nicer in the Lincoln. It's got all different sheet metal in the same way that the Lincoln MKT looks nothing like the Ford Flex, for example. So, you know, you'll see more of that. They're working hard to make sure that people don't get those two mixed up in their minds. You know, it goes back to the old days when you'd hear that the few people who were still buying Mercuries when it was around were people who would buy Mercuries but never consider the Ford version of it. And I think that's probably what they're going to get with the Lincoln. But the Lincoln, you know, when you have that kind of overlap, you're going to struggle to make that a luxury brand. It's premium or semi-premium at best.
But in some cases with the Mercury and the Ford, they were almost exactly the same vehicle.
Oh, they were. No question.
There was no differentiation
except
the nameplate.
No question they were exactly the same, but they were getting people to buy the Mercuries mm-hmm. because they wouldn't go into Ford dealerships.
That's so exactly.
And not enough people, obviously. They didn't keep the brand around. So the Edge, I don't know. To my eyes, I have to say the last two Edges, there was a kind of an update in the 2011 model year was, I wouldn't say the worst, but one of my least favorite models on the market.
Very heavy.
Very heavy. Not a lot of interior space given the exterior space. Just felt heavy. Unfortunately, they say that this new model will be about the same weight. If you look at the weight savings in the body on white, using more high strength steel and some aluminum and so on, they've taken some weight out, but of course more features. And it's a little bit larger. It's 188 inches long. It's up about 3.9 inches or something. And a little bit more wheelbase, a 1-inch increase in wheelbase. So it's a little bit larger, more equipment, and the weight savings is a wash.
You like it?
I like the way it looks a lot better than the current one. We didn't get to drive it, of course. This was just a first reveal. But I thought the design, the styling was much better than the outgoing model. The rear three-quarter, there's some interesting side surfacing along the belt line, including the kind of the upper quarter panel line that goes into the tail lamp that I thought looked kind of interesting. And it's funny to say this because you don't think of this as being like leading-edge design, but it reminded me, it looked a little bit Asian from the back, but in a good way. And I thought it worked. Design-wise, the interior is pretty nicely done. We saw the titanium in the sport model only.
Yeah, very interesting that you're saying there. The weight is a wash because you know, when Nissan went from a body-on-frame rear-drive Pathfinder to an integrated body front-drive, mm-hmm. primarily, mm-hmm. They saw a substantial fuel economy improvement.
Yeah.
And there's other powertrain changes as well. Do you think Ford will get substantial fuel economy improvements?
I think
real world, not just the EPA label.
Well, there you have it. That's the million-dollar question, because my experience with EcoBoost is, we've said this time after time, Eco or Boost, but never the two at the same time. And so especially the way as car guys drive it, we're probably going to get the Boost, but not so much Eco. But EPA numbers, which is really where it counts, especially given the coming CAFE standards, I'm sure they'll get an increase with, especially since they'll be pushing the 2-liter EcoBoost, which, by the way, for the first year, the 2-liter EcoBoost will continue to be built in Valencia, Spain, but they plan to bring it over to the States after about a year, finally produce it here, which... Well, I mean, that has to cost them a lot.
Yeah. The other thing is with EcoBoost is if you start towing, you're talking about the mm-hmm. towing capacity,
yeah.
you get penalized in fuel yeah. economy. You might as well have the bigger engine without yeah. the EcoBoost
yeah.
because it's not going to give you the fuel economy you would if you didn't have your tow.
I guess the idea is that the average buyer is going to tow maybe a few times a year,
mm-hmm, sure.
and then the rest of the time we'll get the benefit of the 2-liter EcoBoost engine, but we'll see.
But if you're of that lifestyle where you're doing a lot of towing, it would not behoove you to buy the EcoBoost.
Jim Farley said something interesting in his presentation, because I was trying to figure out, how do they still have this model as a mid-sized two-row model that's not as big as an Explorer, of course, but it's bigger than an Escape. And he said this is where all the mid-sized, the CD segment coupe buyers have gone. And I'm thinking it's not where I would go, but it's not my kind of vehicle. But I think for people who like that, I think they'll probably find the design fairly attractive and the interior pretty nice and lots of features, lots of safety stuff.
I was still at Ford when the first gen Edge came out, and it was a very interesting product, and I think it's been undeniably successful for Ford,
no
both
question.
From a sales
yeah.
standpoint, but also if you look at transaction price, mm-hmm. that thing is consistently transacted.
Especially in California, it's been a success for them.
Yeah, and when it launched, the prevailing orthodoxy at Ford on sport utilities and crossovers was interior package was king, right? And like the original Ford Explorer was all about an amazing interior package, the 1990 Explorer. And that informed pretty much all the sport utilities that followed from Ford. They always led their segments in package. You know, the 2003 Expedition with that IRS and the full flat third row seat, that was awesome. The original Escape was fantastic. And mm-hmm. that was sort of the Ford DNA.
Yeah.
And then the Edge came along, which was really championed by Phil Martens. He was all over this car, and he saw it just as Jim had pitched it to you, as a move-up car for folks sort of moving out of midsize or coupe. It's another way to demonstrate a certain level of sportiness in your attitude and lifestyle. Not a great interior package, yeah. but a real fashion-forward sort of design statement. And it worked, and mm-hmm. it's continued to work. That's been out for a while.
120,000 a year is not bad. And I think this, I think I might want to coin a new term for it. Let's call it a personal luxury crossover.
That's good.
Remember like the mm-hmm. Pontiac Grand Prix of the late 60s and the Cutlass Supremes and so on? I mean,
yeah.
I think it's probably getting that type of buyer.
It's the Cutlass Supreme.
It's the Cutlass Supreme,
2015.
I'm sure they'd be happy to hear that.
Hey,
in a good way.
Jumping topics here, our Auto Line This Week television program this coming weekend is all about powertrain. And one of the things I had three experts, engine experts on, talking about, we're seeing all this downsizing of engines.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
Ford with a 3-cylinder, 1-liter, Fiat with a 2-cylinder, 0.9-liter. And my question to these guys was, how low is it going to go?
Yeah.
And we had the chief technology officer from BorgWarner on the show. He said 660 cc's, which is what the K cars in.
How about that?
But so what do you guys think? How small a displacement do you think we'll see?
Well, I mean, under 1 liter for small cars, that doesn't seem very much. That doesn't
seems
sound
normal.
Surprising. Yeah, I mean, on the other hand, you have to consider that the 1 liter EcoBoost three-cylinder in the Fiesta, and which will soon be available in the Focus, I believe, although they didn't announce that. But anyway, in the Fiesta, it's only available with a manual gearbox in the U.S.
Right.
And in Europe, they'll sell it with the
DCT.
The DCT. So, you know, it might take a little while before you get the power density in those smaller engines to sell them to Americans. But, I mean, you know, 2-liter turbos in Cadillac CTSs, for God's sake. You know, and, you know, 4-cylinder turbo diesels in Mercedes E-classes. It's
MKZ.
Yeah.
But who is going to buy that? That low of an engine. I mean, demographically,
it's perfect for your next Google car.
as the person that might buy a motor scooter would buy that. It just seems a little too low.
I find it really interesting, though, that look, this 54.5 mile per gallon thing looms ever larger. Last I looked up this week, sales of hybrids, they're still 2.8% of the market. You know. I guess if you make this stuff just standard, people are going to have to buy it. But I think we're going to see smaller engines going forward.
Perhaps, but smaller engines in that you'll see something like the 2.7-liter EcoBoost in the Ford F-150 because you have to look at the CAFE standard and then add in the factor of the CAFE math, which means that if you have a pickup truck, a full-size pickup truck, and Volkswagen doesn't, and that's why it doesn't like the standard, you're going to do well. So, you know, then the question is, are you actually going to be selling more pickup trucks because of the way that formula works and because it's all about the increase in fuel economy? And if you get enough of an increase in pickup trucks, is that where the market goes in the U.S.?
Well, it's just a few short years ago, people would not believe you could get the power you can out of a 2-liter engine, and that they're in so many vehicles and pretty good sized vehicles. Now, my question to you guys is, how low can you go? I mean, I think that was your original question.
Right.
How low do you think you can go on an engine size?
In the United States, I think a liter is going to be about it. In other markets with smaller cars and maybe more forgiving consumers, maybe you get down to 660cc. Maybe we start talking about, we're going to be talking like we're talking about motorcycles. I got a 750. Oh, I got an 850.
It depends on where the A car goes in this country, don't you think? I mean, the Fiat Cinquecento and then the Smart 4.2 isn't doing very well, but the Cinquecento is doing all right.
Mm-hmm.
And, other car, the Chevy Spark, I guess, is the other car in that segment.
Yeah.
So, you know, they're doing okay, and if you need that as a commuter car, it's probably not going to be your suburban family car, but to drive to work, it might be.
But I could see out by 2025, the average engine, to your point, Steve, being a 2-liter turbo.
Yeah, I think so. It could even be on the big side when we think about it. So you mentioned 54.5.
Mm-hmm.
That's about 39 combined on the label, right? So to get it to label math, which makes it seem somewhat more reasonable. It's still a big stretch. Hyundai just introduced, right, their 1.6-liter direct-injected turbo 7-speed DCT in the Sonata, which is an interesting combo. And that's I think it's about a 32 combined car. So you've got a really big car that's a large EPA class interior with a 32 combined MPG, just 1.6 liters. I mean, you know, Ford's been there with the Fusion, but not quite with that level of combined MPG.
Right.
Mixing it with the 7-speed DCT. It's an interesting combination. So we're here in 2015. You know, can we get another 7 MPG? That car's probably right about in the middle of car space, maybe a little bit on the big side. Maybe we can get there.
And this is the reason why electric cars and...
No.
That's a stretch, man.
Because each one gets tougher.
Yeah, they did say maybe. Clear. Twice.
Maybe. This is why electric cars and hybrids aren't doing well. I mean, you've said many times that hybrids are not selling well in the U.S., and I think this is why, because we just keep getting more and more power density out of smaller engines.
I would agree. Hey, we got a bunch of questions coming in from the audience. Let's get to some of those. JJ says, what's up with Daimler's announcement of an S-Class with $1 million price tag? Is this Maybach Redux? Thoughts? It is Maybach Redux. I mean, Maybach, they tried it, they failed. now they've got to try to keep those customers or keep moving the brand up.
The Maybach wasn't that much, though.
No, it wasn't.
No, it wasn't.
And 400 or 500, right?
Well, and I guess the key in this car is that it's going to be such a stretch that there will be four seats in back, or two seats facing each other. That is two and two. And it'll have more capacity or something. But Mercedes is also going to a sub-brand plan with this because they're naming the AMG GT, the exclusive AMG sports car, the Mercedes AMG. Benz is not going to be in the official name. And apparently the same thing's happening with Maybach. It'll be Mercedes Maybach Pullman 600S, whatever. Turbo diesel.
That's right. Hey, Ben, we've got a couple of phone calls in here, too. Let's bring one in.
Hi, this is Jeff W. from Albany, New York. I'm just calling about the new Ford Edge. Is it just me, or does it have a striking similarity to the Hyundai Santa Fe, especially the face?
See, I was going to say something, but I didn't think it would be right.
It's so funny you mentioned that.
I'm going to remain quiet on this. I might have mentioned this to a few friends.
Yeah, my story at automobilemag.com got some of that reaction. Everybody was talking about, well, what does the grill look like? The front of the car, it does look...
here, we got it up here. To me,
there's some Taurus grill. I actually even the Transit grill looks that
shape. And I see a little bit of in the rear three quarter there, a little bit of that the new Lexus. What's that? The NX.
The NX. This is the sport model, by the way, which will be the one that will get the 2.7 liter EcoBoost.
By the trend you can see in rear view, and I think you described it maybe as looking a little bit Asian, but you see it now in crossovers and sedans increasingly. The lamps are going high, right? And the trend is to show more sheet metal between the top of the rear fascia and the bottom of the rear lamp. It gives the car a real strong, sort of facelifted look. Mm.
Well, wasn't the thing with the Asians was they made great cars, but the designs were kind of blah. Now American car companies are emulating Asian car designs. That's interesting.
Well, I think it gets back to Todd's point, is that they want to take this vehicle globally now. It used to be a NAFTA-only car. Now they got to take it global. I think they got to have a bit less of an American look to it, whatever that means. Yeah. The designers tell me there are no more, you know, geographical looks to a car. I'm not sure I totally buy that, but I think this one's got to be styled for more of a global marketplace. Hey, we got another phone call here. Ben, let's bring that one in.
Hi, John. This is Ryan from Overland Park, Kansas. I was just wondering what's going on at Cadillac and why do they seem to have such a churn in their executive ranks? Is it really that bad to work there? Is there some other thing going on there? And what's taking them so long to get into this CUV market outside of the SRX? They really don't seem to have much, whereas BMW, Audi, Lexus, and Mercedes have, or will have soon, multiple entries. Thanks. Love the show. Bye.
Yeah, great question.
Funny shit ass.
Great question.
We're just talking about that.
Yeah.
At least the first part.
Yeah. Look, Cadillac does not have a product problem. That's how I see it. They got a sales problem. Mm-hmm. And they have a general manager who's now in Washington, D.C. as the chief lobbyist of the company, and he still has the Cadillac job. Mm. You know, they can't do this anymore. They got to put somebody new, and they know this.
They've got great products. I mean, I have mad respect for the CTS. It's an extraordinary vehicle. You look at the content in that car, it's 3,700 pounds. It's miraculous from a weight standpoint. Yeah. Just a great vehicle.
It's more fun to drive than a BMW 5 Series.
Yeah.
I mean, the steering, BMW's lost its way with the steering. BMW has concentrated too much on luxury and lost the plot on certain models with the sport sedan. And Cadillac has a chance to take that.
Well, John, as a former CEO of an automaker, what is the deal in terms of the management structure at Cadillac? Why do you suppose that's happening?
Yeah, I don't have good insight into how it's arranged, so I couldn't really comment, Steve. I'm not sure if it's true strong division head. I don't even know. I really don't know anything about it.
But it is a sales issue, and I think when you don't have anybody in charge of the organization or that person is off doing other things, there's a real issue. And they've churned through, I want to say, three sales managers in 3 years' time or something like that. Don Butler, the guy who had been running it, who I thought would get the job, is now over at Ford, and I'm sure he's helping them figure out how Lincoln can just put a knife in Cadillac's back. As we said, it's not a product issue, it's a sales issue. With the ELR, it's a price issue, too. So maybe some of their pricing's out of whack, but I don't know, you guys would know that better.
Yeah, from the ELG
you've
side
got ELG,
of the
right, yeah.
Yeah. We inform a lot of automakers on pricing studies, and we've worked with Cadillac and other brands. They have had some great successes from a residual value standpoint. ATS launch, great residual value. CTS launch, great, with very strong residual values, and they've held. They've got some marketing blocking and tackling to do, clearly some sales help needed.
And there's been some movement in the other divisions, I believe, and I haven't followed it perhaps as much as I should, but Chevrolet and Buick, I think, have had a little bit of churn.
Yeah, there's been a lot of churn there.
So it's probably a GM-wide thing, and yet they're still selling cars well. They're doing very well on sales.
Overall they are, but Cadillac, the red flags are waving.
Right, right.
Hey, let's get to the rapid fire part of the show right now, where we each get to ask each other questions in a rapid fire form, rapid answer form, too. So, Ben, let's let that rip. Okay, I'll go first with the first question. In 2015, Formula One just announced today that they're going to go to standing starts on the grid after every safety car. Think about that. You know, when there's an issue and the safety car goes out, now instead of the car pulling in and giving the green flag, they're going to put them back on the grid, do another start that way. So my question is, and I'll throw it to you first, Todd, and then you guys can go, is F1 becoming too much like NASCAR?
Yes.
Okay. What do you think?
Yes.
Okay, John?
Agree.
Okay. Todd, your turn.
Okay. This one is kind of for John. Has Hyundai and, for that matter, Kia U.S. market share peaked?
No, it will grow. It's got a little more contraction to do maybe this year. Maybe this year can hold last year, but new products coming, new capacity coming, future looks good.
Even without a full-size truck, for example?
For example.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, I just flew in from L.A. I was there for a few days, and I saw a lot of Mercedes-Benzes, and I saw a lot of BMWs and some modern-day muscle cars. I didn't see one EV on the road. Is there a future for EVs in this country, a serious future, other than just something to talk about?
In Santa Monica, I think the Tesla Model S is the single most popular car right now. I mean, you can't turn around without seeing a Model S.
And I saw a lot of Leafs in Honolulu. So in Santa Monica and Honolulu, the answer is yes. And everywhere else, the answer is no.
And I would say yes, but only certain models again as well, a certain brand. It's hard to figure out how long Tesla can sustain what it's doing in terms of selling cars and yet not making any money at it. For the time being, they're the hot brand, not just as a car brand, but hot brand, period.
Red hot. You got a question for us?
I do have a question, but I want to give some context to make sure you guys get it. So Mary Barra was on Matt Lauer's Today Show today, and she was asked a question by Matt that has caused some controversy. I don't know if you heard it.
Yes.
Did you?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
I did not.
Then I'm just going to ask the question. Sorry, Todd.
It's okay.
The question is, can Sergio Marchionne be a good CEO and father both?
I think I can figure the context on that.
That's good. Because Matt Lauer asked Mary Barra
exactly.
If she could be a good mom,
yes.
Which no interviewer would ever ask a male CEO.
I was surprised to hear this.
That was stupid.
I really was surprised.
Yeah,
to hear
it was stupid.
That.
I'll answer yes, that was a stupid question.
Yeah.
But how old are her kids? Aren't they reasonably old? It's not like they're in diapers or anything.
No, they're not, right. But, yeah, it was a dumb question.
It's still, you're right. I like the way you did that. Because that gets to the crux of the issue.
Okay, I got one here. The sinkhole at the Corvette National Museum. Ever since that sinkhole, destroyed like $1 million worth of Corvettes, and, they caught it on video, their attendance, their membership, and their merchandise sales have skyrocketed at the museum to the point that they're actually going to put some of the wrecked Corvettes back in the hole to maintain this jump up in attendance. So my question is, Should General Motors put sinkhole displays at all its dealerships?
Filled with cobalt.
And all the recalled ignition key locks. Yeah.
You guys are crueler than I am. Okay, Todd, you.
Well, my answer would be, I think there are some sinkholes in some dealerships. Oh. Right. Not all of them.
I like these
Not
answers.
All of them, but
oh, these are good answers.
Ask you to think about what you think an upcoming car is going to be, and this has something to do with something we published at automobilemag.com today. Will the next Chevy Camaro be a radical redesign, or will it be a mild? Will it be as mild as, say, the 2015 Ford Mustang?
Radical. Substantial change.
Substantial change. John?
It's sort of a heritage car. It builds on Camaro heritage elements. So I would say moderate, more than the 15 Mustang, but not crazy.
Yeah, I agree. How radical can you go?
Well, I had heard, and what we had published, is that it might have some cues, and we don't know how much, obviously, but some cues from the second generation Camaro, whereas the current model, leans on the 69 Camaro. The next one might be a little bit more 70 and a half.
Interesting.
That
wow.
one, interesting.
Yeah, well, let's see if it turns out that way.
I thought it was a very Italian-looking design, mm-hmm. 70 and a half.
That was a very handsome car until they had to add 5-mile-per-hour bumpers and so on.
Yeah.
For just a couple of years, it was a very handsome car.
Yep.
Steve?
Well, Ford made a big deal recently about Al Mulally being an advisor to Mark Fields in his new position as CEO. And I'm wondering what you think. Does Ford or does Fields specifically need the shadow of Alan Mulally as he's trying to get his footing as the CEO?
You know, I saw that. I saw a story on it. I'm not sure where it came from. But the way I read it was I told Mark I'll always be there for him. So if he wants to, you know, call me or text me or email me, I'll be there. You know, Snapchat, whatever they might do together. So my sense it was just sort of, yeah, I'll always be there. Of course, I'm a Ford guy. This is Alan saying I'd love to continue to serve the company if I can.
Yeah, I think there's going to be some sort of advisory consulting fee.
Something
thing.
More.
When
formal?
I hear that, yeah, when I hear, oh yeah, to me I took it to mean there's going to be more of a formal relationship as an advisor, but not get. Get out of Dearborn, and we'll send you a check every month. But, yeah, we want to be able to
get
call
it. Get to Dearborn Heights, at least.
If the question is it a good idea, I think the answer is no. I think, because Mark Fields has had these last, 6 or 7 years to basically study under Mulally when, you know, before Mulally came along, it looked like Fields might get the job ahead of him. And so there's a little bit too much cult of personality there. I think there's no need for Alan Mulally to stick around. He did a fine job. I'm not trying to denigrate what he did.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think Mark Fields has the playbook. I don't think he needs that.
Yeah. You got another question?
What's going to be a bigger hit, the 2015 Sonata or the pretty radical 3-year cycle Camry that they showed at New York?
Toyota can sell like nobody's business. I'll say Camry.
Yeah. Todd?
Boy, this is putting me on the spot. To pick one of those two. I think the Sonata is going to gain on the Camry. The Camry will remain the number one car in its segment, the number one car in the U.S., but I think it has some to lose.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, Steve?
I think the Sonata is really well done. They showed it at the New York Auto Show, and you were talking about the radical design, you know, like, what do you do next? And your colleague, Larry Dominique, was telling me at the show, he says, you know, they went a little conservative this time, but you can't always be topping your next radical design or else you're going to ultimately end up with something looking really weird.
Yeah. Doing the second radical design is always much harder than doing the first radical design.
More risky.
Okay, last round. I'm starting. Elon Musk and Toyota's Jim Lentz have been trading barbs, a war of words between battery electric cars or fuel cell cars. Elon Musk calls fuel cell cars fool cell cars. So my question is, should Elon Musk take a page from the Uruguayan soccer star Luis Suarez and bite Jim Lentz on the shoulder?
I think Jim Lenz ought to bite Elon Musk on the shoulder. I mean, I respect a lot of what Elon Musk has done, but I think he's buying his own PR a little bit too much. And will fuel cells make it or not? I don't know, but. No, I think the biting should go the other way around.
Well, that soccer star has been accused of biting three people, by the way, so he seems like a serial biter. But I think Musk, if he were in the fuel cell business, he would be making the statement the other way around.
Yeah. Oh, and let's not forget, by the way, I'm sorry to interrupt, but that Toyota basically helped set up Musk and Tesla in its old NUMMI factory to build cars there.
Yes,
and,
it did.
You've got to wonder what this might do for that relationship.
In fact, they had a RAV4 that Tesla did for them,
right?
Electric RAV4.
Right.
Yeah. For me, I mean, there's room for both. You know, I think
biting both, they're, biting
they're
each
both,
other,
but they should both bite. There's room for two zero emission vehicle choices. They both, you know, they both have no exhaust, and so why not embrace both of them?
Yeah. You know, it's hot.
Okay.
Got another one.
Will Google someday build, or not build, but market its own autonomous car?
I'll say no.
Absolutely not.
Yeah, no way. That would be diving off a cliff.
Okay.
I think the answer is yes, and I think it's because they're drinking some of the Musk Kool-Aid.
Well, they have the money to lose.
Was able to do.
They got the money to do it.
I didn't say build because the rumor is that they had Roush build these 100 cars that are test cars, but you know, Sergey Brin is on record saying that the autonomous cars that Detroit's building or that you know that the industry is building are not transformative enough. So I think they're buying into the Musk playbook.
Steve, last question.
Okay, well, this goes back to Tesla. Should Tesla be allowed to sell vehicles to consumers direct from the factory versus through a dealership network, which is being opposed by a lot of dealer associations throughout the country?
Hmm. It's a great question. You know, I think right now with his price point, they're $97,000 cars. It's a typical transaction price for a Tesla. The volumes are very low. You know, it's not causing any harm, and there are people learning from this experience, right? I'm a huge fan of the dealer franchise system. I don't think this model scales. So, you know, I think we can all maybe watch and learn. I think there will be issues in the future that approach won't be able to handle, that the franchise network can, and that will expose that. But, you know, I'd hate to say we should just shut it down. You know, it seems to be... you know, an interesting thing that everyone talks about. There had to be a question.
I'll say no. He should not be allowed to. There should not be an exception to the rule. Either you let it for everybody, but you don't carve out an exception for one car maker.
And Steve, that was your question. Should there be an exception? Should he be?
Should be? He be allowed to
continue
do that? Yeah,
as he's doing.
And
well, he's
just the other side of the picture.
Of
is he? They don't have a dealership network.
I know.
You know, from the beginning.
But he wants a store.
So,
he wants his Apple-like stores,
yeah.
Right?
And,
so.
And which presumably means he's going to set up service bays. I mean, I don't know. But I think the answer is yes. I'd like to see it happen just because I'd like to see what would happen. I think you're right. The numbers we're talking about, the number of cars don't matter. That's not what the dealers are afraid of.
No, what John is saying is it doesn't scale.
Yeah, I don't think it scales.
And that's what they
say.
In
the end, he's going to embrace a franchise solution. For now, or perhaps he will. I don't know what he'll do. But for now, it's small volume and it works. At larger volumes, it gets much more complicated.
Yeah, he's saying they wouldn't sell enough to build a dealership network that would pay off to the dealers. And then the other fear is that with so many dealers being multi-franchise, that the salespeople are not going to pay enough attention trying to sell Tesla as a niche EV. They're going to go for the high volume, you know, high gross things that put money in their pocket.
Look, with that, we ought to wrap up the show. Nice round of rapid fire there. I love doing it this way. John Kravchuk, thanks so much for coming
great
on.
Great to be
this
here.
This is really
great
cool.
To see you,
this
John.
Is really good.
Steve.
We only scratched the surface with you.
There's so much more.
There is.
Ask
there
me
is.
Back. I'll come back anyway.
Okay. We will ask you back. So, Todd Lassa, awesome having you here as always. And Steve Finley, great having you here, too.
Thank you. Good to be here.
I want to remind everybody, or not remind them, let you know, there will not be an after hours next week. We always shut down this operation the first week of July, so everybody can have a little bit of time off. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time and hope to see you then.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 6 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.